Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
...2024 is officially upon us. I'm James Witham. Of course, this is the Down and Nerdy Podcast, and so excited to kick off the year with you. You know, I'll be honest, I've been having a lot of trouble lately getting new episodes recorded and done. I got the flu. Wouldn't recommend it. By the way, it kept me down for a while. I couldn't talk. I could barely move. So, yeah, episodes going to be coming out on a more regular basis now that I've gotten over that thing, and it was a crazy 2023 for me. So I thought this would be a good time, as I do every year. If you're a regular listener, you know what's coming here. Let's look back on some of my favorite interview moments of the past year. It's been so fortunate, even throughout the strike and before that, because, I mean, the strike didn't last all year, right? So there were so many great interviews that happened during the strike and before the strike, and I wanted to look back at some of those and talk about some of my favorite moments and favorite stuff that I talked about last year. So I'm going to do a little different this year. It used to be I would do clips, right, from the interviews. And I thought to myself, why don't I just play the whole interview in case it's from an episode that you missed or something like that, right? It just makes sense for me to try and play the whole interview for you. So I got a few interviews, well, more than a few, as you'll find out here in a couple minutes, that I wanted to throw at you. And I'm going to start, and these are in no particular order, by the way. These are just some of my favorite moments of the year. But one of the shows I talked about a lot this past year was from this big MGM Plus show, the big horror thriller. And there's just so much going on in the show. And it was such an incredible second season, especially episode 6. Was a huge one. And I got to talk to Courtion Moore, who was one of the stars. I talked to almost the entire cast of the show throughout the season, but I got to talk to Courtion Moore, who plays Ellis, about episode 6, and boy, was it a big time to talk to him. So if you haven't watched season 2 of From yet, first of all, I recommend it. Second of all, yeah, there might be some spoilers in here for the first 5 episodes of second season, so just be aware of that. But one of my first things I want to look back on this year is my conversation with Courtion Moore from.
Courtion, what's up, man?
What's up, James? How you doing, man?
Doing good, man. Doing good. Just going to try to talk about this without spoiling anything because, man, it's going to be a crazy ride here coming up. As a matter of fact, I want to talk about that for a second because Harold sent out a tweet after this week's episode yep. 5, and he said that this upcoming episode is a game changer. So I got to ask you, man, is episode 6 the biggest game changer of the series to date?
Oh, without a doubt, man. Like, without a doubt. I mean, look, I keep you know, in touch with the Reddit, with Twitter, with the cast, with some of my friends who are watching it. And the big thing that people keep saying is, like, episode 6, man, I hear episode 6 is going to be crazy. And anything that anyone has heard so far is literally not even the tip of the iceberg. It is, without a doubt, in my opinion, the craziest episode that we've shot out of both seasons. It's going to be hard to beat.
So as we try to tread carefully here, not spoil anything, I got to ask you, just for you specifically, how difficult were these next couple of episodes actually for you to film specifically?
So for me in particular, they were really challenging. And once people see it, they'll really understand why. It's a little scary for me to talk about. But man, look, I'll say this. I could not have been happier to have Jack Bender behind the camera and in the director's chair for 6 in particular, because it is just so much. It's so big and it's so important to the story of From. I think that's the big thing. Is as crazy as it is and as much crazy shit goes on, it really is that episode that changes everything. So it was hard to, you know, to be able to live up to the writing and to be able to keep up with the stamina that people like Jack and Harold have. But I think we all pulled together, and I know I slept extra long every night, you know.
I bet you did. How much of that did you know was coming as you're going into filming for this episode? Did you guys kind of have an idea of what was going on? Or is it one of those things where, because I know you guys kind of get the scripts as you go. So was it kind of a big surprise of, oh, so this is happening today?
Dude, I think we found out maybe like 2 days before we started shooting episode six. I think it was 5 and 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, so we started shooting 5 and 6 at the same time because we block shoot, right? So you do 2 episodes at a time every few weeks. And we got 5, which people have finally seen, which is a really great chance for us to kind of check in with all the characters, mm-hmm. especially now that Sarah's back in town. And we're all like, okay, so we kind of have our bearings now. We've checked in to see where everybody is. What the hell is going to happen at the second half of the season? And I think it was like 2 days before we went to camera on episode 6, we got the script. And I literally could not believe what I was reading. And I don't know if you've spoken to Ricky, but Ricky and I have this thing where every time a new episode comes out, he's one of my best friends. And every time a new episode comes out, we get together and we read it. And we were literally jumping around my apartment like, oh my God, are you fucking serious? Are you kidding me? This is crazy. It was just a shock. It was a shock to me. And I really know it's going to be a shock to the audience.
In more ways than one, for sure. But in all this chaos, Cortian, we've got Ellis and Fatima. It's one of the few feel good stories that we actually have going on right now. How special, man, is that relationship? And how the hell are you planning a wedding in this town?
Man, first of all, Pega is just such an astounding actor. And being able to work across her has been probably the greatest gift I've had since I joined the cast. You know, working with legends like Harold, working with, you know, who's now one of my best friends, like I said, Ricky, that's all been great. But for me, the bread and butter has been working with someone who I personally am deeply in love with. And as you know, Ellis is just completely head over heels with. That relationship is really special to me. I think that is at its core, that is the heart of who this guy is. He's just in love, and he's trying to stay alive for that very reason. And I don't know, wedding planning is hard, man. I think we, you know, maybe got Julie and Donna helping us arrange some things, getting some flowers from the garden, and it's nearly impossible, but I hope that they can figure a way to do it. I hope
you and me both, man. People have got
some speculations, and they don't think it's going to go too well. So I guess they'll have to tune in to find out.
Yeah, we have to definitely wait and see for that. But we did, like you say, get to see Sarah come back. And Ellis was actually one of the few people that knew before anyone else did that she was back. So that's kind of because he backed his dad's play there. So how far do you think Boyd and Ellis will go to protect one another?
To protect one another, I think there's no end to their loyalty. There's no end to their love, especially on this new, you know, relationship that the two of them are kind of still exploring. It's still really early. I mean, they've kind of had a rebirth and like a whole tread on what it means to be father and son, but also what that means in a place like this. So, you know, when it comes to something like the tough decisions, like keeping Sarah a secret, although it pisses Ellis off, although Ellis is still so hurt because he is still hurt. He's still a kid and he still has no idea how to actually handle these emotions. But on top of all of that, or really underneath all of that, there's that thing you just have with the people that mean that much to you. So he just laid off, you know, and we'll get into even some of that in episode 6. And it's a lot. It's a lot, man. 6. Everything just comes back to 6.
It really does. Really quickly, before I let you go, one word to describe the vibe at Colony House right now.
Shit. It's fucked. Everything's fucked, man. It's just nuts. I mean, like, just between Randall coming in and trying to fuck with our whole thing, you know, and our fearless leader, Donna, seems to have some fear in her. And it's just shit. But it's still, in my opinion, the best place to live because at least houses aren't crashing down. So, yeah.
Cortian Moore, man, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, brother.
Now, I should mention that interview was from episode 471 of the podcast. In case you want to go back and listen to the rest of it, there's more from interviews on that episode too, by the way, just in case you're wondering. One of the shows we said goodbye to in 2023 was The Flash. And you could say what you want about the final season of The Flash, certainly had its ups and downs. But one of my favorite new characters that they introduced in that season was the new Captain Boomerang, Richard Harmon. If you're a fan of The 100, you already know who Richard Harmon is, and I thought he did a great job playing Captain Boomerang in this final season. And my conversation with him from episode 458 of the podcast this past year was so much fun, I had to relive it with you again.
Richard, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing fantastic today. Thank you for having me.
So, I mean, I guess it's this kind of a welcome back to the DC Universe for you, because actually you had a small part in an episode of Smallville in season 8. Did you ever think you'd be back?
Gaunt teenage addict, as I recall.
That's exactly what it was.
I was probably 17 years old. I you know, I was hoping I'd be back. I didn't know it would be, oh God, 14 years later when I was 31. But I'm glad that it came back in the incarceration that it did with Captain Boomerang, which I had just so much fun playing.
Were you a DC guy growing up a little bit?
I was never much of a comic book guy, if I'm going to be honest. I had so many friends that were. I played a lot of Warhammer. That was my thing.
Well, hey, that was your gateway then. Okay.
That was my, yeah. So I was doing Lord of the Rings, Warhammer.
When you get the role, is this one of the things where we kind of do a deep dive to get into the character, or do you kind of go in and be like, I want to try and do something different with this?
I definitely wanted to do something different. Because I didn't know, here's kind of how it went down. I was unaware when I auditioned for the role that it was Captain Boomerang. I had no idea. So when I booked it, I was under the impression that I was playing someone by the name of Razor, which is what the audition sides had said.
Of course, that's what it would be in the notes. Okay.
Yes. So, you know, and that was, I just had a ton of fun with that audition. And so when I booked it and it was Captain Boomerang, I was like, oh God, do I change things? And I kind of reached out to them and sort of inquired if there was anything different I needed to do, considering that it was Captain Boomerang. And their response to that was that they want me to do exactly what I did in the audition, playing whoever I thought Razor was. So that's kind of how that went down. And I was glad about that and went like, yeah, I kind of know that he's been played before in different versions of him. And they gave me a lot of comfort, because there is a bit of a fear in that of misrepresenting a character that obviously people know so well. And they made me feel very comfortable with taking the risks and sort of just playing him a little bit different and just having fun with him, which was really, really, as an actor, I mean, that's really all you can ever want out of your bosses on a show. And they really gave me the freedom to kind of go and do what I wanted with it, which was tons of fun.
And you absolutely did that too, man, to very well so far from what we've seen. So we know who Captain Boomerang is. We know who Razor is. Who's Owen Mercer?
Owen Mercer, I mean, that's the other thing, is trying to figure out who kind of this version of Owen Mercer is. And the way he was described to me was, I think they might have wanted someone just a little bit bigger. It was kind of what they had told me. But then when they saw me, they decided to go a different way with it. So we kind of played him like he was just this guy that had just gotten the crap kicked out of him in prison for years. And, you know, he was just the lowest level of the totem pole. And now he's been funded by this much more wealthy sort of backer than he is. And he's finally got the technology to be the big bad guy on the block. And he just relishes the opportunity to not only get his ass kicked anymore, actually do some ass kicking. And that's sort of how we played Owen in this sort of version of him.
I think we could talk about it now, because it's been out there for a little bit. I think we could talk about Red Death a little bit. How much can we tease about that relationship, other than is it just a mercenary thing, or are we going to find out maybe there's a little bit more going on there?
I think for the most part, it is just a mercenary thing, that the Red Death is using Owen and some of these other rogues to do their bidding. Yeah.
So we actually got a look at that Red Death suit for the first time in episode 2. How incredible was it to see that thing for the first time in person? Because on screen, I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, it's super cool. I mean, in person, all I could think about was like, man, that must be uncomfortable. Like, can you see out of that? I don't think that they could very well. And then Owen's over here. You can't see him, but he's over this way. And me being like, hi.
I swear I would strut in my Captain Boomerang get up and be like, oh, I'm so comfortable.
Yes. And like, that's the thing, is that the Captain Boomerang getup is so comfortable. It's just like it's a tailor-made jacket. And like, it was a little chilly. And like, luckily I have a scarf.
I want to thank you guys for making that cosplay possibility so much easier in the future.
For everybody. If the day comes where I get to see somebody come in as Captain Boomerang when I'm at a convention or something, that'll make me very happy. And I was really glad to see that they were doing something that was so accurate to the comics of what Captain Boomerang wore, which was super cool to me to actually be able to play him and kind of look like him in a way, which was very cool.
Is that the cool thing for you, that you talk about going to cons and things like that? When you get a role like this, is it a little bit cooler than some other things, because you're like, okay, once you're Captain Boomerang, you're Captain Boomerang for life. in the eyes of certain fans. How cool is that?
It's insanely cool. And it's also very, it was a little bit stressful at the same token.
Like, of course.
I know that you and I have discussed a previous show of mine when I was on the 100 and was doing that. And like that, John Murphy wasn't even in the books of the 100. So that character was so fully me. And like, there was no one could ever get mad at me making John Murphy however I wanted to make him, because there is no John Murphy until there was Richard Harmon playing John Murphy. So that was a lot more open. So then when you're playing someone like Captain Boomerang, that people have thoughts in their head about the mm-hmm. way that he should be and the way that he should be portrayed, which I completely understand. And I can completely understand if like my version of him is not for everybody. Like, I could completely understand that, but I'm really grateful for the openness that seemingly that the fans of The Flash have brought to me. And like, a lot of them really were very complimentary of it. But I also understand the other way of that too. And it was just nice to get the chance to play.
No doubt about that. Really quickly, I want to take a little bit of a side note on that, because the 100 fans, that is a very loyal and still very active fan base. And if you look at the comments on this guy's social media, all these 100 fans saying, oh, I didn't know you were going to be on The Flash. Now I'm going to have to start watching The Flash. How cool is that for you that they're still hanging on and they're coming to The Flash because they see that you're attached to this project? I mean, that's got to be amazing for you.
I'm incredibly grateful for it. I wouldn't have the apartment that I live. I wouldn't have the life that I have without the 100. So it's something that I'm still to this day, and to the fans, incredibly grateful for, that they're still sticking around.
Talking to Richard Harmon, who plays Captain Boomerang on The Flash, which you can watch every Wednesday night on the CW. Richard, now that the Fiddler's in the mix, it looks like we're going to get kind of a bit of a rogue squad going on here. So this is something the Flash fans have been waiting for a while on the show, myself included. So how much fun was it to kind of be a part of a team of villains and be the first one to kind of kick that off this season?
It was to be the first one. That's exactly what I was going to bring up. Like, to be the first one was a very cool thing. That like the first episode of the season, it was before you even know Red Death is a thing. It's like Captain Boomerang's the first one that you mm-hmm. see as the first obstacle that you think like, oh, maybe he's just going to be someone that the Flash just knocks down and moving on to the next villain. But to stick around, kind of get the better of Flash, and I wouldn't say get the better of him, but like kind of end in a stalemate between the two.
Kind of did though, a little bit.
I got the better of him at least twice.
Yeah.
The timelines, the repetition.
Sorry, Grant.
Yeah. So I think that's very cool to be the first one and to be part of the group. Like I said, because me not being a massive comic book guy growing up, for the showrunners and everyone, the writers and everything, to kind of like made it very clear to us how important this is and this group is, and what that forces, without any spoilers, what the Flash has to do to kind of combat the numbers game of us versus him.
Absolutely. So this is the final season for a cast that's been doing this for quite a few years now. What was it like working with all of them, and how was it to kind of walk in? You're the new kid on the block in the final season of a very much beloved show that people have been working on for a long time.
Yes. I mean, it was so welcoming. I'll say that. Like, for my first day was all with Grant and doing the battle between him and me three different ways. And that was my first day. It was just an all-day affair. And Grant was so welcoming and so awesome. Like, there's a reason why a show can go 9 seasons and not many can. And you have to have a great leader for a cast. And he embodies what it is to be a good number one. He really does. I can't say enough good things about him.
Oh, I can absolutely agree with that too. As a matter of fact, speaking of this cast, I've been around them enough to know they're a fun bunch. They're a very musical bunch too, by the way. So do you have any fun stories from when the cameras weren't rolling that you can kind of share with us a little bit?
Oh boy. I mean, I was so focused on just trying to not mess up Captain Boomerang, but there were so many fun moments. I think some of the most fun moments was just Grant and I sitting there with like him with the, just eating like pasta with the Flash suit fully on, like in the hell, like the mask and everything, and just eating pasta on the side of the road in the middle of Vancouver. Those were sort of surreal, comical moments for me. And then I have a few photos that crew members took of the two of us that I think are pretty funny. And I think maybe when the whole thing's wrapped up, I can maybe post some of those for people to see behind the scenes a little bit.
Nice. Got a little something to look forward to. I love that.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder though, because I can imagine that at some point Grant's going to drop something on that suit while he's eating. What's the protocol when you're in the Flash suit, The bow tie pasta falls on the Flash logo. Is it a fire drill? Is there bad things? Have you seen something like this happen?
That's why they only serve the red sauce. That's it. It's tomato based. Everything lunch, tomato based, everything red. That's all it is. That's all we eat on the Flash.
Just a different shade, just in case. Yeah, well, then you're wearing your blue trench coat and then you're in trouble.
True, but that trench coat is easy to. I'm a professional, you know. I'm not.
Of course you are. Of course.
But so is Grant. I don't. I never saw the man drop anything on his suit.
how cool was that look for you? You talked about it being a practical look close to the comics. How cool was that look for you for the Captain Boomerang suit? Because it was very comics accurate, and the boomerangs themselves were. It was that cool to just, you know, you just kind of open up the trench coat and you're like, hey, what's
yeah,
up?
Jingle jangle. I mean, like we had to do quite a bit of ADR to fix, because sometimes the boomerangs would just clang, or we would just be in the middle of a take and a boomerang would just fall out onto the floor. And I'd be like,
of course,
a boomerang down. We just need to take it back to the top on this. That happened a lot, was that boomerangs would just start falling out, because I had like 25 on me at any given time. And they're secure, but they're not that secure. So they would just start falling, and like ding 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 ding, just falling all over the ground. If I'm like doing a fight scene and I'm punching, and then it's just boomerangs all over the ground.
Kind of can't drop those.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't have that.
I know that you said that you were nervous, and there's so much great writing that happens on the show, and always has been. Did you
they're
get a
so
chance?
Lovely to the writers.
Oh, I'm sure they are. So. I know that, you know, Captain Boomerang, he's known for his zingers. Did you kind of get to throw in a couple of ad-libs there as well? Or did you kind of, were you too nervous? Oh, you did? Okay.
I did throw in quite a few ad-libs, and they were really, really welcoming to allow it. The one that I'm sad didn't make it in was in the first episode when they, after the, not him and his wife knocked me down and I'm getting up from behind the car and kind of in pain. And I was going up to them and I was just looking at them. I was like, power couple, nice. And I wanted to keep the power couple thing. And I was like, power couple, very cute.
I like that.
And I was like, damn it.
See, now everybody knows what could have been.
Kept some other ones, which was really cool. I'm trying to recall which. That's the thing, is that they did such a good job writing that it became so evident to me what the ad-libs would be. And that's on them, is making it so clear and evident what this character's like with those zingers.
Mm-hmm.
When I ad-libbed things, it... At this point, I don't even remember what was mine and what was theirs, because they did such a good job of making it clear what he would say,
mm-hmm.
what type of person he is, which was really, really, that's when you're ad-libbing, that's incredibly helpful.
And you had to pick up on that, though, and that's where the team aspect and the trust comes in, though, I can imagine.
That's what it's all about.
There you go. There you go. Before I let you go, Richard, I know that we've barely scratched the surface of what we're going to see this season on The Flash. How excited are you for fans to see what's coming? And would you love to revisit this character at some point?
I would absolutely love to revisit this character. He was so much fun for me. I want one day for people to see the audition tape actually for him, because that's Ooh. A lot of fun. And that was too much ad-libbing. Yeah, that's like, bring it back. But I mean, they got me the role, so that's good. I'm very excited for myself personally to see, because I don't even know everything of what happens on this season. And I'm curious myself to see where they're going. And how they're going to wrap up this beautiful story they've been telling for 9 years. And I was just grateful to be a part of it for my little bit of time.
See, and if you don't even know where it's going, that means it's going to be really exciting. Because, I mean, that means they kept things really secretive.
Oh, they did.
Too. Richard Harmon, thanks so much for the time, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, one of my sneaky fun movies that I watched in 2023 was Knights of the Zodiac, the adaptation of the anime of the same name. It's very, very popular, and I know some people didn't dig it, but you know, I had nothing to base it off of to compare it to, because I really never saw the anime. So here's the deal. I enjoyed it, but what I enjoyed more was talking to the cast of the movie, and specifically Madison Eisman, who plays Athena in the movie. Well, she's not the only character she plays, but you know, Athena is the big one. So here's my conversation with Madison Eisman talking about Knights of the Zodiac. This happened on episode 469 of the Down and Nerdy podcast earlier this year.
It's been about 40 years, Madison, since the original anime series. Did you familiarize yourself with the material, or did you want to go in clean?
Well, 40 years ago. I'm just kidding. I was not alive.
Let me tell you a tale.
Let me tell you about 40 years ago. I when this was first brought to me, I had no idea what it was. But then I quickly jumped into research and found out that it never really hit in the United States, like it did literally pretty much everywhere else in the entire world. I had a lot to catch up on, basically. But I mean, it was so fun to jump into it. I always love diving into source material of new things, especially when it's loved by so many different people. It's exciting and it's fun because people care so much about it. But I mean, it was a lot. I think I had about 2 or 3 weeks to really dive in as much as I could. And it's a lot of pressure, you know, it's a big role. It's not a small one.
Absolutely not. It's actually a dueling role in a way too, because, you know, Sienna is definitely one of the most interesting characters in the story, if not the most interesting character in the story. So once you get to know more about her, what excited you the most about playing her?
I mean, other than her costuming and hair and makeup, which was some of my favorite, you know, I think I love where she ends up, and I don't want to give any spoilers, but I also, if we were to continue and do more movies, which is always the goal, where she will go is also very exciting to me. This is, you know, it is the very beginning of this whole universe and this story. Our film is an introduction to these characters and sort of how broad this universe is. So it's just a small taste of what we're going to get into. So I think that was always like the most exciting thing to me, is like where it's going to go. And I've always been a fan of like big concepts and big stories and big characters. And I feel like we just barely scratched the surface of how big it can actually get. So that's exciting to me.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. When you guys see it, you'll understand exactly what she's saying. But it's got to be hard for her, though, because, you know, she has this power looming inside of her. We saw that in the trailer. But do you kind of feel like it's more difficult for her that she really basically doesn't have a choice or control over basically anything in her life?
Yeah. And that's like, you know, it's such a parallel theme in our film, because at the same time, Saya, played by our lovely McKenyu, when these two characters meet, they're both dealing with the same thing. They're stubborn. They don't want to handle the cards that they've been dealt in life, and they're doing everything they can to possibly not, but, you know, they sort of create this bond throughout where they sort of have to face their realities eventually and do it and believe in themselves and believe they can do it. So, I mean, yeah, it's the journey she goes on. It's inspiring. And I always find like I sort of have these parallels with these characters that I jump into time and time again. I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's subconscious or why I do it, but, you know, she's sort of having this imposter syndrome throughout. And, you know, similarly, so many people love this story and they love Athena. And so I've found myself, you know, time and time again, just like, are they sure it's me? Like, did they cast well? Like, you know, and there's big shoes to fill. So, you know, I was kind of with her throughout her whole journey of filming.
I think they casted pretty well. I don't think you need to worry about that at all. I've seen it. Yeah, I think you're good.
Thank you.
I think it's safe to say that she has a very complicated family life. I want to start with Dad, though. How special is that relationship between Sienna and her father?
First of all, Sean Bean, old Sean Bean. I mean, I'm such a huge fan. I'm actually rewatching Game of Thrones right now, so I'm like re-fangirling over the fact that I already worked with him. I mean, that relationship, I just think it's so important. I think it's such a grounding part of our film, and they're some of my favorite scenes, I think, the two of us together. It's one of the really only times you see them as human beings who are actually dealing with the weight of life. But Sean Bean, I mean, he could read the dictionary and it would be interesting. He is so good. And I'm so glad he is who is telling most of the exposition in our film, because it's a lot, right? It's a lot of information. And if you've never seen the original anime or manga, it's a lot to dive into. So the fact that Sean Bean is going to spoon feed you all of the information in our film, you're in for a treat because he does it so well.
That is true. If you're going to get the information from anybody, yeah, he's probably the guy. Yeah, you want to get it from.
I want to read, you know, all the stuff in my life. If I have a biography, I want Sean Bean introducing me. Forever.
Oh, for sure. For sure. But when we know that he's keeping her safe for a reason, because we got this army that's coming after her. So tease for us a little bit. How dangerous are these people that are coming after her?
I mean, they're pretty dangerous. They can pretty much take whoever they want. You know, we're dealing with Cosmo, which is this all powerful force and power that can quite literally destroy anything in front of them. So yeah, these are not the guys that you want to get in an altercation with. And so Allman, who's played by the lovely Sean Bean, has sort of created this fortress to keep Sienna in and keep her in hiding. And it's got these like crazy walls that come down, you know, when her Cosmo is being detected. And so I don't want to spoil anything, but that's all I'll say. But yeah, you don't want to mess with them.
anytime, if you're seeing this on camera, anytime she looks up and to the right, she's really she's really trying not to say where it's like there's a little sign up there saying don't do it, Madison.
It's so hard not to spoil anything.
I know it is. I've seen it too. I get it. I'm trying not to do the same thing with these questions, but I do want to talk about Saya and that relationship too, because he's the champion that's supposed to keep her safe, and he certainly has a lot of skills. So how much can you tell us about how the two of them kind of get along initially? Because it's got to be weird meeting somebody and be like, yeah, this is, you know, she's the embodiment of Athena sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, they're very parallel in a sense. Like they have both been dealt these cards in life. They are both stubborn. They don't want anything to do with their destiny. And it's funny because they really don't enjoy each other at first at all. But, you know, sort of through them dealing simultaneously with these similar situations, they find a bond together. And I won't say, see, now I'm looking to the right. I'm looking to the
now you're gonna be thinking about it.
But, you know, it's a theme in the movie that you never get tired of seeing, which is sort of this, not enemies to lovers. That's the wrong theme. But, you know, watching these two people sort of like hate each other and then sort of find some sort of sense in the both of each other and find a bond on that. And then McKenna, he's just so great. And he's such a talent and so easy to work with. And we just had a lot of fun together.
Oh, that you could definitely tell that for sure. We got some incredible action in this movie, Madison. I mean, just in the trailer alone, but that, like you said before, scratches the surface on this thing. So how much were you looking forward to possibly getting in on some of that? Because you had to see some of the stuff that everybody else was doing and going, I got to get a piece of that.
I keep telling Andy, I was like, Athena needs to do more. Come on. Fomka got to do some fun stuff. And I was like, Athena can do a little more. Andy Chang, who did all of our stunts, he's incredible. He's a legend. It was so much fun to watch. And his whole team, they're just so incredible. They were able to create such a fresh, organic style of fighting that I've never really seen before in a film. It's very unique to our movie. And I think it's one of the key elements in our film that makes it stand out. He's so good. He's so, so, so good. And it was so fun watching them fight. And then it's fun, you know, you on set, there's no special effects or anything, but then like watching it all come to life, it's so impressive. But yeah, I want to do more. Andy, let's do more, Andy.
hint, nudge, nudge sort of thing. You talk about the look, and that's definitely something I wanted to get to, because that was one of the wow factors for me, was just that look of Athena. And again, we get like a small smidgen of that in the trailer. So how impressed were you with this look and just the design of the character? Because it just pops so much.
Oh, I'm so glad. It was very collaborative, and it was a lot of conversation. You know, it was, I think the trick with live action remakes is you want to stay true to what was done 30 years ago, but also you want to bring something fresh and new and a little more grounded and just different. So it was, you know, we talked a lot about if we wanted to stick with the manga where she has this like golden brown hair, or if you want to stick with the anime where she has this like vibrant purple hair. And then also even the costuming, like you want to modernize it. And our amazing costumers, they wanted to bring in a little more Greek mythology since it's such a driving force in our film. And even like Athena wears this bronze breastplate that has the symbol of the owl, which is Athena's symbol. You know, there's all these tiny little details that if you pay enough attention, you'll see. But I do remember the hair was a big conversation. And it was one of the only things that I was like, guys, like, you gotta have the purple hair. It's just gonna be so iconic. But you know, they wanted it to be, you still wanna make it grounded. You know, you don't want it to be ridiculous. But we did lots of like hair and makeup tests. And I remember when I first tried on the wig, Yoshi, who's been a part of Saint Seiya for so many years, he started to tear up a little bit, and I was like, okay, I'm like, come on guys, like, we got it.
And then there's the right choice.
Yeah, but I think we didn't make that decision until like the morning of filming. I remember, wow, I was with our director and they still hadn't made a decision. I was like, they have to have the wig ready in the morning. And so he was like, let me sleep on it. I went to our hair and makeup trailer in the morning and he finally gave me the text. He said, put it on. I was like, are you sure? Because if it goes on, like, you know, we don't go back. That you make the decision. You can't really CGI out, you know, a whole wig, I guess.
No.
Nowadays, you probably could. They can do anything now. It's pretty crazy. But yeah, it was very collaborative. It was a lot of fun to sort of give my ideas of where to take the character and costuming and hair and makeup and Tomek and everyone, but it was all done, you know, with the fans in mind. I think that was important to me, was to make sure they got the Athena that they would want in a live action.
Madison Eisman, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
This week, the Down and Nerdy Podcast is brought to you by Claritin D. And tis the season to breathe pollen. Yeah, I've been spending a lot more time outside with the kids recently. And yeah, I can tell those allergies are definitely acting up. I feel stuffy. I feel sluggish. The eyes are starting to water a little bit more. That's why I'm turning to Claritin D. Look, it's definitely helped me relieve my symptoms. It seems to work really, really fast for me. As well, it's designed for serious allergy sufferers. Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongestion in your nose so you can breathe better. And hey, I'm noticing a lot of that right now. As a matter of fact, I'm looking forward to be able to enjoy much more outdoor time this spring and summer. A lot of that has to do with Claritin D. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin clear. Use as directed.
It's my favorite interview moments of 2023 here on the special edition of the Down and Nerdy Podcast. Of course, I'm James Witham, and it was just so much fun talking to so many amazing people, as it always is. And you never know who are you going to talk to sometimes, right? You never know what's going to come across. And one of the things that I found was Marvel's Mockingbird strikeout from a Kanye press, and or Kanye books, I should say. And Maria Lewis, the author, got to talk to her. She's Australian. She was so much fun. And we didn't just talk about Mockingbird. We didn't just talk about Marvel stuff. We talked about a whole bunch of stuff. This happened on episode 475 of the podcast. My conversation with author Maria Lewis talking about Mockingbird and, yeah, a bunch more.
Maria Lewis, author, thank you so much for taking your time. What are you doing?
Hi, thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me. And thanks so much for giving a shit. It's delightful to talk to people who are excited about the book.
I mean, how can you not be when you got a character like Mockingbird on the forefront? We'll talk about, you know, joining the Marvel world here in just a second. But I actually want to talk about Mockingbird because like I said, she's one of those it characters that has this like special following within the Marvel fandom. So how excited is it for you to tackle a character like this?
Oh, she was like a dream character for me. I've always, one of my favorite things about Marvel broadly is that I think they have one of the best toy boxes. Like, obviously you have all your characters that people are really familiar with in the MCU, your Iron Man's, your Captain America's, et cetera. But because they have existed for so long, the benefit of that is you have this amazing deep bank of characters that would be considered like you maybe B or C list characters compared to your more well-known ones, right? Even though Iron Man would have probably been considered B or C list until the MCU really took off.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, 100%. So it has been something of a dream, I guess you could say, to get in there and to play with some of those characters that I loved that every time they made an appearance, you know, whether it was usually small, but even if it was just like, you know, Bobby pops up obviously a lot in West Coast Avengers. And I don't know if I necessarily would have been drawn to West Coast Avengers if I didn't know Bobby was in it. Like, she was the reason I was reading that, because I wanted every bit of Mockingbird I could get. And there's other characters like She-Hulk and Tigra, for instance, who are sort of within that world, and Black Widow for a big stretch there in the 90s. And so I was very excited because there's this bank of characters like X-Men, I think, also has a bunch of really great ones. Loa, for instance, who's a Pacifica X-Men. I'm Pacifica, so that's a character that I was always like, any little morsel of representation you're excited about, but also like your Jubilees, your Rogues. And any time that there was a possibility you could pitch on something like this, I was always telling myself it would never happen, but like, you got to roll the dice, you know what I mean? You only need one yes. And so I had pitched on a whole bunch of characters. And Mockingbird, I thought, was going to be a long shot because I know she has a real cult fandom. And obviously, she popped up in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So her like general fan base has expanded a little bit because of Adrian Pilecki's incredible representation of her on that show. So I was just cautiously optimistic that maybe she would be the character that I got to play with, and it ended up being the case.
So you're going to make me go off on my first tangent here for a second,
okay,
because of
go,
what you just mentioned.
Away.
Just because what you just mentioned, you mentioned Adrian Pilecki, and I yeah, totally I agree her. With you. I loved her portrayal of the character, but there was supposed to be a spinoff of
yes,
Agents
they
of
shot
S.H.I.E.L.D.
it.
Most Wanted, that was, you know, killed before it was even brought out. So I feel like fans are going to see this and be like, finally. Did you kind of have that feeling too, where you're getting to take this character and be like, okay, while it might not be TV, right? You still get to finally give her the story that she deserves, that she didn't get to have on television.
Yeah, well, the thing with Bobby historically, not just in the comics, but also like in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you're part of an ensemble, right? So it's like you have a different character might shift through and they're leading the A-plot week to week. But generally speaking, Bobby was kind of always defined by her proximity to men. Like her first introduction in Astonishing Tales, she was sort of like one of Kazar, which is such a bizarre character, one of Kazar's many hectic love interests. And Spider-Man, same sort of deal. She was like, I'm no femme fatale. And, you know, that's just, it's a different time. You can't necessarily, I feel, judge things from the perspective of 2023 when it's written in, you know, 1974 or whatever. So I had always been really intrigued and enticed by the prospect of sort of trying to liberate Bobby from the context of men, right? What happens when she really does, quote unquote, strike out on her own? And some of my favorite episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., particularly obviously season 2 and 3, are where Adrian Pilecki plays Bobby and Nick Blood, who's amazing, I feel, as Lance Hunter, come into play. And Lance sort of being this problem-solving character way to fix the issue of not being able to include Hawkeye in the TV series, but them still wanting to have this ex-husband plot point, right? Which is one of Bobby's big pieces of canon. I thought was a really clever solve for that. And I loved the chemistry and the magnetism between the two of them. When they got written out of the show to branch off and have their own pilot, which they shot, and I don't know, I'm sure you have sneaky people who've flicked you a link and you've seen
it. I haven't seen it. I'm trying. Haven't seen it yet. Wonder Woman's another story, but I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh, I enjoyed that as well for very different reasons. but it was one of those things where it's like you have to shoot your shot, right? Like the odds of Most Wanted could have been picked up and it gets 5 seasons. So them getting written out of the show would have been totally worth it. Tragically, it did not. But that was one of the angles, I guess, I'd always been intrigued with in terms of Bobby. And I have 8 books before this that are all dealing with women who have various abilities, right? It's taking classic mythological monsters and giving them a feminist twist. So it's women who have to struggle with great power comes great responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. Some of them are villains, some of them are heroes, some of them are just in between. But the women who exist within the Marvel Universe, who for the most part are not superpowered, there are obviously whole comic runs where Bobby is or has, you know, enhanced abilities. Those characters really intrigued me as well, because it is this play field of like gods and monsters. And how do you, not to quote the Dark Universe, but, you know, how do you operate through that world? And like, what kind of skills do you have to develop? And you're exceptional by anyone's standards, but yet there's a guy over here who can fly. And there's a chick over here who's like a brilliant lawyer, but can also turn green. And so that sort of juxtaposition of being exceptional and ordinary at the same time within an incredulous world, I think, was such a rich playing field. And just having the real estate to spend, you know, 85,000 words with Bobby Morse, like I would have read any book. I have read every book with Bobby because I love this character. And I just wanted to sort of try and balance that expectation of her legacy on the page and the screen and like pay homage to that, be respectful of that, pay tribute to it, while also hopefully trying to take the reader somewhere new and take Bobby fans somewhere maybe they hadn't been before.
How do you kind of make that balance though? Because you've got all that history, you've got all that canon, and we know how people feel about their canon, right? But then you've also got Maria over here, and you've got someone who's written like almost 100 Who's Afraid books and created so many characters. How do you balance the, I want to bring a little Maria into this with also saying, okay, but I have to remember there's canon over here.
Well, it's really interesting. Because this year in particular, like 2023, I have three books coming out that are all so incredibly different from each other. Obviously, you have this Mockingbird novel, which is in the world of superheroes. I have a slasher called The Graveyard Shift, which is like a millennial scream coming out, and a crime, a murder mystery crime book. And then I have an Assassin's Creed novel coming out at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. So they're all incredibly different. And it had been sort of interesting, I guess, because with the Supernatural Sisters series, which includes Who's Afraid and The Witch Who Caught a Death and stuff like that, that spanned 8 books and many years and various short stories and whatever. And so you have this fan base that's really familiar with you. But then my primary job is as a screenwriter on film and television. And so there's an audience that comes with me from that who are familiar with my work through episodes that they've watched or things that they engage with on socials. And then there's things that I'm just passionate about, like geek culture, you know what I mean? Like I'm covered in pop culture tattoos. I really live my, like wear my pop cultural passions on my sleeve, quite literally. So you have all these different audiences related to you that are coming to this book. But I would say majority of the audience, probably 85% of it, have no clue who I am and have never read anything I've written before and are coming to this because it's Marvel, because it's Marvel heroines, which is a line that's like really has a very passionate fandom, and because it's Bobby. And so it's a combination, I think, of trying to balance, well, understanding that you're probably never going to successfully appease everybody and sort of letting that pressure go, letting that expectation go, and trying to write the story that you feel best serves the particular narrative that you've set out to tell, the narrative that you've been greenlit to tell, because you have to go through a very extensive pitching process with Marvel approving at each stage of the pitching journey. So you can't just suddenly go off reservation and be like, surprise, there's dinosaurs now. Could you imagine? Oh my goodness, I would love that so hard. But yeah, somebody hired me for that book. But just being really conscious of trying to balance those two things.
So Bobby's not going to ride a velociraptor. Now it's just totally ruined for me now. And I can't do it.
I feel like she has the Chris Pratt Jurassic World character. She would be a very good, you know, substitute there.
Oh, no
Her
doubt.
In blue going off on adventures.
That would be fun. That would be fun. I would read that.
That would be fun.
Hello, if anybody's listening.
Studio crossover that literally nobody wants, but you know, the two of us are
well
excited.
I mean, there's
it.
An audience right there then that said, we'll just do that
exactly.
so Maria, it would have been really easy, right, to take a novel like this. You've got the Marvel logo on the cover to lean into comic book aspects of things like the Super Soldier Serum, which you have in this book, and things like that, but I feel like at its core, to me anyway, this is really kind of a cross between like an espionage thing and female empowerment as well. Did you want to kind of give it a little bit different of an angle in that way? Comics have deep meaning. I don't want to say they don't, but did you want to give it a little bit more of a different spin on what we've normally seen from Bobby?
Yeah, I think also I was really interested, again, like because she, in this version of the story and the pitching process of this, she was, it was specific that she had to have no superpowers per se, right? So for me to be able to ground the audience and ground the stakes, I wanted to try and keep her a little bit separate from that world. I also thought the canon, you can tell I've just been obsessing over Across the Spider-Verse, the canon event of her and Clint getting divorced is, I think, something that if there's one thing people know about Bobby, it's probably that. That's probably in the top three things they know. So I really wanted to open with that and then immediately leave it. So we're subverting expectations of, you know, if you're expecting this to be all about that, it's not necessarily, it's about the aftermath of that, right? And this idea of essentially trying to do a superhero divorce book, which is, you know, some of my favorite comics of all time, are very adult themes within the package of the superhero mechanism and the superhero device. And so I was thinking about things like Out of Sight, the Steven Soderbergh movie, which is one of my favorite films of all time, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and this idea of a lot of tradecraft and a lot of spycraft mixed with chemistry and interplay between characters, but also wanting to move Bobby away from a place that audiences felt they were very familiar with her in, which wasn't just the emotional relationship with Clint, but also the physicality of California. And so I looked at a few different options of physical settings and what I needed the story to service, this essential mystery where you could put all of Bobby's strengths and all of her weaknesses on display to really dissect and dive into. And Oxford was an exciting option for me. I mean, it's just truly like one of the most interesting settings because there's so much rich history there, but there's also so much fascinating modern history there as well. And so many like different little options to play with without getting into spoiler territory, but it also brilliantly puts her in the backyard of Strike and meant that I could tap into the ring, some of those characters that people might have been not as familiar with, not just Lance, but some of the other Strike entities as well. And try and take people somewhere that they haven't been before. Like my previous books, the Supernatural Sister series, each of those is set in a very specific geographical location, whether that's Berlin or whether that's, you know, Sydney, Australia, or whether that's Boss Castle in Cornwall or Dundee in Scotland. It was about doing a little bit of literary tourism, you know, me going there and experiencing those places and to speaking to people who lived there, researching them and making them feel lived in. And I wanted to do that with this story as well. I loved the idea of Werewolf by Night when that dropped, like the adaptation, I should say. But this idea of a one shot where you're taking something that people feel like they really know very well and then moving it somewhere unexpected and doing something unexpected with it. And this being just like a little capsule story. And that's what that was my intent with this. Whether I succeed or not is really up to the readers, but that's what I was essentially trying to do.
No doubt. And obviously this is more about Bobby than anything else. I feel like this book is, but you still have a mission. You still have a goal. And I feel like what you have is more of like a target than a villain. Like you kind of say, okay, well, every story, a Marvel story has to have a villain, and you kind of do. So what made you decide to kind of go the route that you did of finding, I'm just going to say the word target because I don't want to spoil anything, obviously, but what made you decide to go kind of that route? How much can you tell us without spoiling anything?
Well, Bobby's backs, again, this is like the challenge of trying to balance things that are canon and what parts of canon you can keep, what parts you can't, you can change, etc. Because obviously things get updated, things change in retrospect, like either, you know, super sexist or super racist or super whatever. And so you're constantly trying to stay faithful to the origins of the character while updating it for a modern audience and for a modern lens, which is what, for me, the best characters do, my favorite characters. I'm a big fan of the first masked superhero ever, the Phantom. I worked on an audio documentary about the Phantom. And what was so fascinating about that character, even though for the time that character was very progressive compared to other characters, it was something that it was this white man in the jungle, right? And it was really fascinating to watch how that character evolved and how that character then became essentially the Superman for Papua New Guinea, for India, for all these countries that didn't really get to see versions of themselves represented in comics. And so I'd always been really intrigued by that idea. And that was something that everything I approach, especially with legacy characters like this, it's sort of very similar with the Assassin's Creed book as well, is like, what is the thing that I can bring? And what is the thing that I love about the source material, and how can I infuse a little bit of myself into it, right? And in the case of Bobby and the story and the target slash villain, if you will, it was being aware that there'll be people reading this book who have no idea who Bobby Morse is and might not be familiar with her backstory outside of, you know, maybe one or two appearances, right? So again, you're trying to balance people who have lots of knowledge with people who may have none. And so I was trying to find ways to include people into the story rather than exclude them. So there's Easter eggs in there, obviously, if you are very familiar with who she is. But if you're not, there were still pieces that tied back to her origins. And I was trying to layer in some meaning there about the choices that we make when we're really young and really ambitious. And, you know, you want everything right now all the time. And then how those choices and how those decisions can be colored as an adult when you're looking back. And, you know, the things, you know, it's like your first relationship compared to your fifth or your sixth, mm-hmm. right? Or like how you raise your first kid compared to your fourth or your fifth or whatever, you know, just the things that you don't know what you don't know until you know it. And so
no doubt
sort of trying to, yeah, like trying to layer that idea in the context of Bobby, in the context of who she was as a woman, as a scientist, and as a spy, and trying to sort of balance each of those simultaneously all the time. I feel like I've said balance 25 times as if I'm in Cirque du Soleil or something, but you're just
trying
was
to,
like,
you're just trying to center us, make it more Zen a little bit. Which is this Zen Australian. You're the first Zen Australian ever.
Wow, I think you might be the first person ever in the history of my life to call me Zen, but let's roll with it.
You set me up for it. Speaking of setting things up, though, because I feel like you talk about changes, and I feel like everybody in their own story, you have to make changes to certain things. How do you set a reader who's familiar with Bobby and her story and is just this huge fan of hers? How do you set them up for something in a story like this where you're like, okay, this is going to be a little different. Don't freak out. How do you set a hardcore fan up for something like that so you don't have people screaming at you on Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that?
Well, I feel like people are always going to scream at you regardless. So you've just got to, like, you know, peace out and just like make your Zen closure with it or whatever. But in this particular instance, I'm a massive fan. I love to love stuff. And I love all the characters that are in this book. I asked if I could use them because I love them and because I'm a fan of them. Maria Hill, Tigra, She-Hulk, even a little like sneaky Daredevil appearance, Lance Hunter, obviously, other characters who shall remain nameless, but pop up in various instances. Hawkeye as well, big fan. But it was trying to sort of come to it from the perspective of, like, I've been that person. I've been reading these books and these stories forever. I'm a massive She-Hulk fan, for instance. And I remember reading this book that came out, I want to say it was like 2014, by Marta Acosta, which was another Marvel novel. And it was called The She-Hulk Diaries. And I remember at the time loving She-Hulk on the page, but just feeling like that book really took it to another level. It was very adult, and the themes were very contemporary, and it was sort of like dealing with her as a woman and a corporate entity, and dealing with her as like a, you know, somebody like as an adult, like as somebody with sexual agency and career drive and all these different things. And so that was very much like a touchstone for me, because I was just like, I loved that book and I loved what it had the capacity to do. But also, I have read so much of the stuff, and I feel like lots of, for instance, Chelsea Kane did such an incredible job on her run. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that. She's already done that.
Right.
And therefore, I'm giving the true fans nothing if I'm just repeating that beat. So it was about trying to take a journey that felt gentle. You know, you're taking somebody off the beaten path, but you're holding their hands while you're doing it. And I'm sure there'd be people who could be frustrated that there's not more Hawkeye in it or there's not more whatever. But the reason I love Bobby is because of Bobby, not necessarily right. who she's in a relationship with. And the reason I love her is because of how smart she is and how compassionate she is and how empathetic she is and how cunning she is. And like, all of those different elements to her that make her special and have made her such a fascinating character historically, those are sort of the things that I wanted to see. And it's not necessary, you won't pick up on all of them. And like, the science has to be balanced with the physicality, and the physicality has to be balanced with the character stuff and your witty banter and all those things. But trying to have a really even mix of the core elements that make Bobby who she is, while at the same time moving the story somewhere we haven't necessarily been before, which again, geography really helped with that, but so did choosing certain characters. And even things like the book opens at the Academy Museum in LA, which is, there've been lots of stuff with Bobby set in California, but I was like, okay, what are the set pieces we have seen with her? Where are the places she has been physically and interacted with physically? And then where's somewhere new I can take her? And at that particular point of writing it, the Academy Museum had only just opened up. So I was like, okay, cool. I feel like we haven't had that many stories that have, you know, had her riding the shark from Jaws into a crowd of baddies, you know, just like relatable stuff.
That was definitely really fun. And if what she said didn't get you jazzed for this book already, then I don't know what to tell you, honestly. But I
feel like they're
going to
be
ahead.
Very mad at me destroying half of their museum on the page. But
yeah, hopefully that doesn't actually happen in real life. Yeah. Before I let you go, Maria, you talked about Assassin's Creed a couple times now. How much can you tease for us about what's going to be coming from that? Because, I mean, again, there's a lot of Assassin's Creed fans that are just itching for more Assassin's Creed stuff.
Yeah, it really blew me away, honestly. Every time I feel like I have a grasp of fandom, again, as mentioned, because I'm in it and I work in that space, something like the Assassin's Creed novel comes along and the announcement of that just like shut down my phone for like 3 days. You forget. You don't forget, but you do kind of forget when you're really in it. I'm a huge fan of Assassin's Creed. I think anybody who loves storytelling loves and respects Assassin's Creed because of the world. And I also love, I guess, I don't want to say alternate history, but things where there are stories woven in and around and amongst historical stuff that we know already, historical events. And so obviously this ties in with the upcoming Assassin's Creed Mirage, and the main character of that game, his mentor, Roshan, is the main character of this novel. So it's someone that you've had glimpses of in the games before, but again, similar to Bobby, it's about spotlighting that character, giving them a whole platform to really, you know, get to shine and get to understand some of her backstory, get to understand why she joined the Brotherhood in the first place, the things that are important to her, why she is the way that she is. Yeah, I've honestly really enjoyed the process. I love working with Ubisoft. I've worked on a game with them for the past few years, not Assassin's Creed, a different project. And just the amount of time and effort and energy they put into research and they put into specificity as a storyteller, it's just like a dream come true that you have that much breadth, I guess you could say. It's very hard to talk about without spoilers as I'm yammering around subjects.
Well, I can see them lording over us right now. It's somewhere over in the
like,
distance saying, now
get
stop, stop. Maria Lewis, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much for the great questions.
Of course, how could I go through this entire episode of Best Interview Moments of the Year and not talk about Comic-Con? Yes, Comic-Con was a little bit different this year, but that doesn't mean that there weren't some fun interviews to be had. As a matter of fact, there was a new audio drama or audio fantasy series from Audible called Third Eye that I got a chance to talk to some of the members of the cast and the creator herself, Felicia Day. So instead of just giving you one bit or a little bit of that, I'm going to give you the whole thing from episode 491 of the Down and Nerdy podcast from the Third Eye press room at Comic-Con. Here's my interview with the cast and creative team behind Audible's Third Eye. If you're looking for a new scripted podcast to try out, Third Eye is available right now from Audible on Amazon. And Felicia Day's big, big project that maybe you've heard about and maybe you haven't. Together, I've got a few episodes in now. It's a really cool fantasy story that's got some, you know, fourth wall elements to it as well. And at Comic-Con, I got a chance to sit down with Felicia and some of the cast and creative minds behind Third Eye to talk to them about this thing. And actually, it was a roundtable discussion. And the first question asked of Felicia was about, you know, why she wanted to tell the story in this format. And she kind of dove into how she's been with this project for a while.
So this project was my dream TV project, actually, and I tried to sell it in 2015. It was my follow-up to other things I've done, and it didn't happen to sell, and it was very heartbreaking because I had put everything into it. But the wonderful thing is that I got the opportunity to talk to Audible about doing it, and they decided to do it, and they were like, you're doing 10 episodes, which was such an incredible gift. And because it happened to be over COVID, I wrote pretty much everything myself. So, you know, when you're writing 10 episodes of essentially television, I made it exactly the way I wanted to make it. And I will say that, you know, having been a part of a torturous development process through Hollywood over and over again, this was an incredible experience. And it's exactly the way I want it to be.
So you know me, when I get a chance to ask a question, I'm always going to ask about the characters if nobody else has yet. So I asked Felicia about her main character.
What's your favorite thing about Laurel?
My favorite thing about Laurel is the arc that she goes through. The reason I wanted to tell the story was I didn't want to do something fantasy-like. I wanted to talk about something fantastical, but I also wanted to talk about a failed prodigy. I was a violinist when I was a kid. I was a prodigy in that, and I was also kind of a prodigy in the internet world because I was so early. But with that kind of overachievement at a very early age, you kind of can't ever live up to the expectations that people have for you. And having that sort of crushing self-doubt and not really valuing yourself for who you are was something I really wanted to talk about. And so I was able to put that in this very common trope of all the genre stuff that I love, which is the chosen one. Somehow, you know, you're anointed to be the one to save humanity and what, or supernatural attitude, supernatural world. And what if you fail? How do you live with yourself? How do you live at all? And how do you heal yourself in a way? And that's what I wanted to talk about. So that's what I love about Laurel, is this journey I take her through and the fact that it parallels a lot of the healing I've done personally in my life.
So one of the next questions for Felicia was if she wrote any of these characters with the voice already in her head and mind, and I thought she gave a couple of really good answers here.
I mean, I definitely wrote a part for Will Wheaton because he's one of my favorite collaborators. He's so incredible in this part. I think it's one of the funniest things I've ever heard him in. And it's also heartfelt. All the people who are in the cast, except for I think one person, was a personal friend of mine. And that one person, who's London Hughes, blew me away. So my friend Jonah Ray, who I've worked on with many projects with, he came in and did the vocal direction because I've worked with him on camera and we worked so well together. I was like, can you direct this for me? And I said, we have one of the main parts uncast. And it's my best friend. So it's one of the most important parts. And I just had this idea of this, you know, hotness, you know, British girl, and like, I don't know somebody like this. And he's like, oh yeah, I know this girl who I did stand up with. And I watched 15 seconds of a YouTube video of her stand up, and London Hughes just, I fell in love with her. If you meet her, you're gonna fall in love with her too. She's a star, and she's one of the sweetest, most talented people, and she embodies hot mess in the best way. So yeah, everybody, I mean, of course, I always wanted Neil Gaiman to do the narrator, but you never know. Thank goodness everybody was able to make time to do the part, and honestly, it's a dream cast. Everybody just brings the characters to life in ways I could never even imagine.
Third Eye does have a very interesting villain, so I wanted to ask Felicia a little bit about Tybus and learn about that side of the story as well.
Talk about your villain a little bit, Tybus. Was there any specific inspiration behind that character?
Well, again, we have the Chosen One against the Big Bad, right? And these prophesized characters who take over, you know, all of our fantasy and sci-fi tropes, right? Christopher Judge plays that part, and it's because I loved him in God of War so much.
Of course.
He's such an incredible performer and actor in person. So I was like so thrilled when he agreed to do it, because you know, it's an audio, you know, it's an audio project. Like, it's different. I'm just so thrilled. And you know, at the same time, everybody had to be funny. And it's really hard being the biggest badass evil person and also be funny. And he nails it every step of the way. So I'm really excited for people to hear him play this character. Again, like the style of the project, it's a comedy fantasy, but it's not sketch. Nobody's playing a sketch character. These are real characters, real stakes, real life or death circumstances. And that's what I wanted to imbue in the project.
This next question was a very interesting one because, you know, with Felicia, there's going to be Easter eggs and fourth wall breaking and stuff like that. Somebody asked, you know, how aware are these characters of our world, or how much are they a part of our world as we know it?
So basically, the world building is very deep because I'm into world building, and we don't even get to explore, but the tip of an iceberg of the world, which is really interesting. But we stay in our world, but basically there's a supernatural world that's secret among us. And like I said, like there's a, you know, an unhoused person might be, you know, a legendary Russian folklore god or something like that. So everybody exists, all the world, all the creatures and people from folklore and fantasy exist, but they're hidden amongst our world. And that's kind of what I wanted to do. I want people to listen to this and then drive down the street and be like, oh, I wonder if that psychic shop is a front for a fairy. You know, I really want to bring magic to the world that we have around us versus escape into a different world. That's this one is all about grounding in reality. And that kind of is reflected with the soundtrack. Like most of the songs, which are amazing, are from the 60s and 70s, you know? So it really is, I wanted a place and a time of, you know, San Francisco with that kind of vibe, that hippie vibe. I wanted that to be embodied in the world.
So you heard Felicia talk about London Hughes a couple of minutes ago, who plays Sybil. Well, yes, I did get a chance to talk to her in the roundtables for Third Eye. And the first question to her was, what was it like to voice such a fun character? And yeah, you're about to fall in love with London Hughes. All right, check it out.
it was very easy to voice her because I am also a fun character. So literally, it was just me. I didn't actually have to change her voice in any way. It was just myself, high energy, so sassy and funny. So yeah, it was a joy to be the voice of Sybil.
Since this is Laurel's best friend, of course I'm going to ask London about the relationship between the two characters.
Talk about the relationship between her and Laurel a little bit, because I feel like everybody's got their ride or die, and I feel like that's kind of what she is.
Yeah, so Laurel and Sybil, they love each other. They are ride or die, but like Sybil kind of finds that Laurel's quite annoying sometimes. Sybil just wants to live her best life and, you know, steal some money, get into some hijinks, you know, have a good time. And Laurel, I guess she's been through a lot because she thought she was the chosen one and now she's not, and she's in this, not depression, but she's in this weird space where Sybil was still living her best life despite being in that weird space with Laurel. So they clash on some things, but ultimately Sybil's very loyal and that's her girl, and she's gonna help her, and she's gonna, if she needs a ride or die, she's that girl. So I love their relationship, and it's me as a person, I'm very loyal. So again, I don't know how Felicia wrote this character as me when she didn't know me at the time, but yeah, Sybil is basically, she has the moral compass of Sybil, how fierce and sassy and confident she is, but also how loyal and forgiving she is. Yeah, I feel like it was so easy to be her, and it was a dream to work with Felicia. And Felicia doesn't know this, but I really wanted her to be my friend in real life, but it was so hard because she was so busy being a mom. And I understand. She didn't want to go for drinks with me, but I was just like, is this real? Are we really friends? And now I realize we are. She loves me to pieces, so that's great.
I also got a chance to ask London if she liked how this kind of series kind of blended the fantasy and reality elements together.
Did you kind of love that this, I feel like this show blends the fantasy and reality mm-hmm. aspects of life a lot. Did you kind of like that part about the show?
Yeah, it's so modern. Like all the references, obviously there's references for you like diehard fantasy fans, but also there's like references for people that watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Like it's definitely modern, but in a way that's palatable and funny, and then it's got the fantasy, which is in the way that's like old school, but then it's like a nod to the culture, and then she just like weaves in her own real life. It's just very relatable, and it was easy for me, even though I'm not admittedly, you know, a strong nerdy person. As someone who's an outsider, I was like, oh, this is very cool. Like I was very enthralled by the whole world of it and how much attention to detail that she has. Where Felicia wrote this 8 years ago, so she knows all the characters like that. She knows their backstory, what would happen, what wouldn't happen, their names, their full names. Like she told me my full, I don't even remember my full name. I'm like, I'm Sybil the fairy. She's like, no, you're Sybil Agromarai, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, okay, Sybil the fairy. So she really like, and I love that, which made it so easy to work with her and to have fun with these characters because she really knew this world. And I felt like being Sybil, I could really feel, and I knew the world myself, especially when you hear it. Oh my God, the soundscape of it all is insane. So yeah, I think this could be really huge, guys, honestly. I mean, London Hughes is in it and she is amazing. So I feel like it's gonna be a very, very, it's so different to anything that's out right now. And I think people are gonna get addicted. They're gonna be obsessed with this one. I'm very excited.
So I was really lucky to ask London yet another question, and I asked her if there was another character that she liked working with on this series, and yeah, boy, was there ever.
Other than Laurel, was there a particular character, a scene partner that you really liked working with on this one? Because I've got a couple from the first episode, but I want to hear what you think.
Okay, Will Wheaton. Like,
there
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, so we actually got to do our scenes together, and in a lot of it, our characters are... We hooked up and he's still into me and like we have history and I find him annoying now, but I kind of like him. But anyway, when we were acting and doing our scenes, I could see his face. We were in opposite booths, but we could see each other and we'd be arguing. And he'd be shouting at me and screaming. I'd be like, Will Wheaton, screaming at me. Like, this is so much fun. Like, I didn't expect this. It's a Tuesday. So it was very surreal at that moment and he was really fun to work with. But Felicia's so good at being Laurel. She's so good at bringing the character to life that she made me be a better actor because she really was her. And so yeah, bouncing off of her was great. It was so much fun. And then essentially having a director come in, like you do a take and say they have to climb a mountain and you'd be like, he'd be like, okay, so you say this line as if you're climbing a mountain. And you're like, how am I going to say a line? As if I'm, you're like, and then you like practice and freestyle speaking, but being, you know, out of breath. And then you're like, can I take, and it's like, try it this way. And then you try a bit faster, but a bit more out of breath. And like, just that process as a creative was so much fun to do. Like, when do you ever get to do that? So yeah, it was just like a party. Every day I came in and I was happy. I was pretending to fight demons or like do spells and whatever's happening. And yeah, it was very surreal, but I loved it. It was, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Finally, I got a chance to sit down with director Jonah Ray Rodriguez for Third Eye. And one of the first questions to him was if what he, you know, did he listen to anything as research before he came onto the project?
Yeah, I listened to like, I mean, I love, there's like a radio cast recording of Lord of the Rings, which is really good. And I love like listening to old like Twilight Zone radio episodes. Those are really, really rad. And they do a lot of that. They do like a lot of that stuff. And like, there's something like, the audiobook I've listened to the most in my life is Born Standing Up by Steve Martin. And that is like a thing where he's like so good at like kind of like when he starts talking about certain old bits and then talks about like the audience reaction and the feeling of like where, like the physical space. And then in between chapters, it's like nice banjo music. That like, I like thought about all the things I liked about audio stuff. And like, just and, like, I, like, oh, the music, like, you know, like right here should be this kind of thing and the way it fades in and the way it kind of can transition. And all those like old radio shows do that a lot too, which is like so great. And, you know, it's like, oh, like this person has to be far away. No, they're too far away, but like, it's like, you know, yeah. And I remember a long time ago, I went to like Disney World and they had, that was the first time I heard like 3D audio. And it was like in maybe like 92 or something like that. But I remember like sitting and then like someone like walking in and the whole panning audio thing. And I was like, we got to do a ton of that stuff. Is that possible? Is that going to take up a lot of your time? And like, they're like, it's 2023. It's easy.
So one of my favorite things about Third Eye is the fact that Neil Gaiman is the narrator and he's so amazing at it. So I had to ask Jonah about directing Neil Gaiman.
How much fun is it to direct Neil Gaiman, and how much fun was it working with him in that role? Because that was one of my favorite things about the first episode.
Dude, it's like, it was like, what am I going to say? I'm just like, you know, I'm just a joke boy, you know, that like has like showed up and stuff here and there. Like I was like, and I'm talking to like one of the foremost like storytellers of like the Western world, you know, and like I'm I'm sure he'll be fine. And he's very funny and very like, you know, affable, but he's very serious with like, it was just that thing. I'm like, okay, I'll let him go. But like, I was like, okay, you could be a little funnier here. Actually pull back and go more dry Neil Gaiman style. And that was kind of, and then there was like, you know, I told him this, I was like, oh, try it like this and add this line. And he was like, oh, that's funny. And then like, I did it again. Like, and then he was just like, that's not funny at all. Like, it was just like, it's like, and then of course, like coming in and coming out, my self-esteem remained the same, but there was a big spike in the middle of it. You know?
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah.
So you could talk about saving the best for last. And again, I said these were in no particular order, but I'd be lying if I said this wasn't either my favorite conversation or one of my most favorite conversations of the year. I got a chance to talk about Superman and Lois with Wally Parks, who, of course, plays John Henry on the show, or at least he did. Yeah, that's a whole thing. Hey, I'm not going to get into the whole rant again because I've already ranted about this once, about all the casting changes that they had to make and all the people that were cut from the show to get one more final season on the CW. I'm sure I'll be ranting about that again at some point as we get closer to the actual premiere. But just the way he talks about John Henry and being a family man, and this happened at the beginning of this past season of Superman and Lois, by the way. So there's really not going to be any spoilers or anything to be had from this interview. So just keep that in mind as you're listening. This happened on episode 460 of the Down and Nerdy podcast. My conversation with Wally Parks talking about Superman and Lois.
Wally Parks, John Henry Irons himself. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Oh, man, feeling really, really good, especially excited for this season, too. So John Henry and Nat, they're kind of slowly, they've slowly built their lives in Smallville. As this season starts, do you kind of feel like they finally feel like members of this community?
I think they do. At least I hope so. You know what? I think that's the whole idea is like last season was about, okay, trying to figure things out, trying to reconcile the idea of where they came from with where they are now. we've accepted that, you know, Superman's good on this world. Lois exists. She's not the Lois we know, but like, you know, she's there. So now it's like, okay, now what do we do? How do we have lives now going forward? And I think that's going to be an interesting thing about for us this season. Like our relationship, relationships with other people. I'll tell you this, that he's a single dad and she's a teenager and she ain't going to listen. I was going to say that.
I was actually going to ask you about that next, because I was, you know, does this mean if you're being more comfortable, does this mean we're going to see John Henry being more of like the dad this season, doing normal dad things, being worried about his daughter?
You do. And that's the funny part. Actually, to be honest, it was kind of weird shooting some of those scenes because like, I'm so used to like, you know, it being like intense and like, you know, we got to do this. We got to stop Superman. We got to fight this villain. And then it's just like, okay, you got to be a dad. You got to have this talk. She's not listening. Those kind of things. So it is funny. You get to see the whole gamut. So a little bit more comedy with John Henry this time, but also a little bit more intensity.
And I mean, maybe start dating. Would that be something that, how's he going to deal with that?
I, you know, that's the thing. Yeah. It's, I know it's such a cliche. It's like, you know, the daughter starts dating. So how does the father react to it? I'm going to say if she ends up dating somebody, it'll be, I would be curious to see how John Henry handles anything, because I think the interesting thing about him is, you know, and his Lois, obviously, like we said, has passed away. So he's never been a single dad before.
Right.
In my mind, the way I interpret it is that she was the one who would take care of all those things. You know, like Nat could go to her for that kind of advice and whatnot. So he's not that, like, he loves her. He cares about her deeply, but he doesn't know how to handle those things on his own. So it's to see him juggle those, you know, going forward, it's going to be interesting.
Girl dad life can be tough for sure. I totally get that. So I feel like we've been waiting to find out more about John Henry of the current timeline that you're in right now too. Is that something we could finally start exploring this season?
Oh, 100%. Especially, you know, hopefully the fans know already, at the end of season two, it was teased that Bruno Mannheim's going to play a big role. And he's the guy who killed the John Henry of this earth. So we're going to get into a ton of that stuff. We're going to get into a lot of his backstory. This John Henry, my John Henry, is going to learn about him as well, learn about other people. And I'll tell you, as a tease, that's going to really kick off in episode four. Episode four is where we really start getting a heavy John Henry stuff. And it's going to get intense pretty quickly. We'll say that.
It's funny because you just keep leading me into the next thing that I'm going to ask you about. I want to talk about Bruno Mannheim. As a matter of fact, no spoilers, like you said, but yeah. How is Bruno Mannheim different from some of the other villains that we've seen so far in the show? And talk about Chad Coleman, what he brings to the role, because I mean, he's incredible.
Oh yeah, no, I love Chad. Like Chad and I actually met doing a show called All American a couple years ago. So I just like Chad's energy in general, because Chad's very cerebral. You're gonna like, you ask him a question, then you're gonna get like this long answer that kind of goes all over the place. But it makes sense.
Oh, I know, trust me.
Oh, you broke his head. So yes. You get So that's the thing. He brings a sort of gravitas to this. Like unlike, you know, the other villains we had, you know, we had Ali Alston last year, and then obviously me and Tal Rowe or whatever, but really more Tal Rowe in season one. Like you have these superpowered villains. Bruno doesn't have any powers. Bruno is a man who is on a mission, and he has passion, he has dedication. And that's the thing, like that can be really dangerous. I mean, there's a reason that he's become the head of Intergang. There's a reason that they're all following his lead. So you're going to see him get kind of ruthless. You're going to see how he came to power. And it's going to be an interesting season.
There's a whole lot of dangerous that's coming for sure. And fans will see that coming up on full display.
100%.
I want to talk about something else, though, because as I was watching the trailer, when I talked about the first trailer when it came out, I said to myself, it seems like this is going to be a difficult season for Lois. I don't know why, but I feel that in my bones. And even though, like you said, John Henry's, you know, he's kind of moved on. He's realized that this isn't his Lois and things like that. Talk about how emotional this story is going to be for basically everyone and for John, because that connection still has to kind of be there.
It does. And that's the thing. You're right. This is going to be an interesting season. I think, you know, one thing I'm really praising, I praise like Todd Helbing, our first showrunner, and Brent Fletcher, who's now joined him, their co-showrunners, the fact that he's trying to really ground the show. His tagline is sort of like, how do you take a man that fly and ground him? And so that's always, it's always been about family. It's been like, you know, that's something that we can all understand as people. Like, I can't relate to somebody who can like jump over a building and like, you know, literally like pick up bridges and all that. I don't know what that's like. Right. But you can understand the idea of love and caring about people and all those things. So that's what I think the show does really, really well. And you're going to see that this season. I think they're taken into a area which I don't think many superhero shows have gone before. And I really think that, and I hope that people in audiences connect with it. I think it's a storyline that, you know, a lot of people have gone through, and hopefully they'll understand what we're trying to do with it. But we'll see. I just hope we have, like I said, our fans have been amazing, and hopefully they stay along for the ride and they find out.
Very well put. We're talking to Wally Parks, who, of course, is playing John Henry Irons, as usual, on season 3 of Superman and Lois, which is going to come back on March the 14th on the CW. Now, Wally, we've gotten to see John Henry in full hero mode, but he's also had to kind of balance that with getting used to the whole new world, like you said, whole new way of life. Do you think he's still finding his footing as a hero?
Oh, as a hero. I that's interesting. I don't think he's finding his footing as a hero, because I think for him, it's about selflessness. Like, you know, and that's how what anyone, I think, you know, could connect to. It's interesting. When I first got cast, you know, I didn't know I was John Henry Irons. There were dummy sides, you know, like they said something generic name, you know, Brad Smith or whatever. But the way I read it, I could tell it was sort of like a Lex Luthor kind of thing. And that's why, you know, he was Captain Luthor in the beginning. So I came at that from that aspect, like a very selfish kind of man. Like it's all about him. And then when Todd called me and said, no, you're actually going to be John Henry Irons, I had to flip everything, because that's not a selfish character.
Right.
You know, and the whole reasoning behind him of like, you know, like trying to avenge his, you know, the death of his wife and all the, you know, the his earth and trying to protect people here. So I had to flip him from being selfish to selfless. So I think he's already there. That the hero is fine, but I think his journey is just going to be sort of truly letting go and being able to move on, because he's realized he's accepted that this is his new reality, and this Superman is good, this Lois is different Lois or whatever, but I don't think he's fully accepted his past and what happened to it. I think there's a little bit of trauma there. I think he still blames himself in some ways, and I think we're going to see him this year really kind of struggle with that, and hopefully gets to the other side and can really truly just immerse himself in the world and just have a new life.
So do you feel like maybe it's more about acceptance rather than atonement at this point?
Yes, that's what I feel like. I have to be, because like he tried to atone and that didn't work because Superman's alive. So then what do you do, you know? So you have to, like, if that was his whole mission and suddenly you take it away, that's your life's purpose. And suddenly it's like, okay, your life's purpose is gone. What do you do? And at some point, I believe you just have to accept the past as a way to move forward. So yeah, that's going to be his big journey. He's it's a different level this year, and it's going to be cool to see where it goes.
Well, I can't wait to get your reaction to this one, because we've seen that, of course, you said he's, you know, sort of moved on from Lois. He's made his peace with that. But could we see John Henry maybe start to find a different love interest maybe this season?
I would love it just to like have him do something. Look, you know, like, there's only but so many people I can like fight and be intense about. You know what I mean?
That is
like,
very true.
You know, there's always going to be a villain. There's always that. I promise you, we got a lot of John Henry action, like a lot this season. Actually going to be kind of crazy. But yeah, it'll be nice to see that kind of side, like a domesticated side. You know what I mean? Like kind of, I really want to tap into what was John Henry like before he went through all the trauma. You know, who was this guy at his core? And I think we're going to start seeing more of that come to the surface as the season progresses. And yeah, it's going to be nice.
All right. We'll have to wait and see for that one. So I've seen in some interviews that you've done where you talk about how well you get along with the cast and how much everybody gets along and how much you enjoy working with one another. Do you have a favorite story that you could share with us from when the cameras weren't rolling? Something that really sticks out in your mind?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's not a favorite, just like a recent one. This is just so
That's dumb. Good too. Hey, that works for me.
Yeah. It's just because over the weekend, because like, you know, we're filming the finale right now, so we're winding down. And so we did a little cast thing at Tyler's place, just like, you know, like as the last weekend, last hurrah. And we decided, I don't know who introduced this, but there's something like a hot chip challenge. It's something like there's
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. It comes in like individually wrapped in foil and then in a box coffin. That should be enough warning not to do it. But I'm not the brightest, apparently, because I, along with a bunch of people from the show, and you know, we decided like, oh, we're going to like, let's try this together. And it didn't go well. I mean, went as well as expected insofar as if you eat something that says this is dangerous and you shouldn't eat it if you have a heart condition, it's probably not going to be good. So we were over there just together acting the fool and like we do it all together and we started. And like, at first we were like, oh, it's fine. This is easy. Then me, like the idiot, I'm like, oh, let me take another piece. Cause like,
man,
I know. And Sophia follows me. And so we're like it kicks in. And then it's just all of us just going around just being like, oh my God, oh my God. Oh my God. And of course it's only the fools. It's like me, Tyler, Sophia, a guy on our crew named Brody and David, Bitsy's husband. Bitsy and Emmanuel have nothing to do with it. They just, I'm like, do you want to join? And they're like, No, you're idiots. So I know they're smart. Women tend to be smarter. So it was it's things like that. That's, again, you're right. Like, that's to me what makes it fun, because, you know, you're shooting for 14 hour plus days every day, and you know, it's tiring, and like the weather up here is like, you know, brutal sometimes. So to have that kind of camaraderie and that fun, it's really good.
That's incredible, man. I love that story. I really hope there's video of this somewhere that is going to get released at some point.
I was gonna say, there is video. I will see if it gets out, because it's, I look kind of stupid.
I'm sure they'll tag you then if that's the case.
Yes.
So you, as your character starts to evolve, obviously, as you become more of a member of the community, is there anyone that you haven't gotten to have a lot of scenes with up to this point that you're going to get to work with a little bit more this season?
I will say my dream, because she's my work wife, is Sophia. Sophia has me. You know, like we just, because we always joke about, we hang out the most, and but we don't actually interact. You know, like, we'll see if it happens more this season. I think the good part about what we ended last season is that a lot of people now know, are in on the secret. Because, you know, sometimes it feels like there's a superhero side, then there's another show. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because not everybody knows. So because more people are involved, we start getting a little more interaction with other people in the cast. So it's cool. Yes, but I would love more scenes with Sophia, because I just love Sophia and we're great.
Before I let you go, there's a lot of changes going on in DC right now and CW in general, you know, with James Gunn and Peter Safran coming in. What are your hopes for this show and for John Henry beyond this season?
I mean, at this point, look, I know as much as everyone else. You know, no one knows. We it's all sort of, you know, up in the air, because you're right. There are so many changes going on in a grand scale. I mean, like, James Gunn already laid out his 10-year plan. So my hope is, like, yeah, I would love to get another season or two in, at least, because I would like us to end. I'd like us to know ahead of time so that we can really craft a good finale. And like I said, we don't know. So I think if we got a heads up, I would love that. I think that'd be good for the storyline, for the fans. And look, yeah, would I love like a John Henry theoretical spinoff? Yeah, I'm not gonna be like, oh, please don't give
yes.
me a steel spinoff. Yeah, I'm not stupid. Do I think that's gonna happen? No, realistically, I'm a realist about this stuff. I don't think it's gonna happen, but I've just been glad to be on the journey at all. It's just been really cool to just play superheroes and get to talk to people like you who are wearing a Superman shirt, which, by the way, I noticed. And that's, thank right. you so much.
Gotta represent the brand, gotta rep the brand, yeah. And make sure that we're all watching. Willa Parks, thank you so much, man, for your time. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me, James.
So that's it. Some of my favorite interview moments from the past year. Of course, you can always relive every interview, every show, by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts to the Down and Nerdy Podcast. You can always listen at downandnerdypodcast.com. Of course, on the website, there's timestamps on there and stuff, so you can skip to segments of stuff that you want to hear and, you know, skip around a little bit. So that's, you know, that's, it's always a feature that I know that people love. You can also follow along on social media at downandnerdy757 on Twitter and Instagram, at downandnerdy on Facebook, at downandnerdypod on TikTok. I will say, as I start creeping towards 500 episodes, there's going to be some changes coming. I could tease that for you a little bit. There's going to be some changes coming to the show. Not going to tell you exactly what those changes are going to be, but it's going to be really something I'm really excited about. Don't worry, the heart and soul of the show is still going to stay the same, but there's going to be, you know, just a couple of little tweaks here and there that I think you are really, really going to like. Thank you for spending part of your year with me. Thank you, as always, for supporting me, supporting the show all these years. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be doing this. And I certainly wouldn't be doing this for as long as I've been doing it. If you've been a supporter from the beginning, or maybe you just found the show here from these interview samples in this best of show, welcome or thank you. Either way or both, thank you so much for finding the show and listening, because I'm forever grateful for your support. And I also want you to remember, as I always say, you never have to apologize for being a nerd. So let your fan flag fly and be good to your fellow nerds.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming, quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that. As well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.